welcome back to This Week on Channel 9. I'm Dan Fernandez, and our special guest...
Rick Barraza.
Now, Rick, I am proud to announce that you joined our team.
Absolutely, I did.
Along with Brian Peake, who we see here. Rick, for people who don't know who you are, why don't you give yourself a quick intro?
Sure. I'm Rick Barraza. I usually do a lot of rapid prototypes. That's how we've worked together a lot in the past, kind of designer-developer hybrid. So I focus a lot more on what we're calling the modern developer, since build, and on a lot of those types of emerging technologies and kind of where they intersect with design technology and telling a great story, too. So really happy to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited to have Rick on the team. And, of course, Brian, who lives in Giovanni's friend, who a lot of people we talk about on a regular basis, Brian being a regular Coding for Fun contributor, he's also joined the team, and Brian's been working on Coding for Fun for a while, and now he's an official FTE. So I'm super excited to have you guys on the team. Yeah.
My first Coding for Fun project actually used Brian Peake's managed DLL. So
yeah, so. Which I think was it for the mix contest show off?
That was 2008, I believe it was. Yeah.
Okay, because I think Brian Keller and I, who Brian is, I think at Code Camp, were I think the judges on that. That, if I remember
there
correctly.
There you go.
Yeah, and I was like, this
all
is
comes
a
full
crazy
circle.
Video. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
So, cool stuff. We're glad to have you on the team. And lots of news, so let's just jump right in. Our first story is actually from the Windows Store for Developers blog, and it's an update post that we missed last week, but really, I think the key here is for people to understand how big the Windows Store is for developers. So you can see the quotes here. It's going to enable developers to sell apps into 200 markets, support for local currencies in over 70 markets, and developers can localize their apps in more than 100 languages. And the big thing is they have updated the app submission from 41 markets up from the 27 markets that was originally announced. So definitely a lot of cool stuff going on in terms of the store, and I think a lot of people are really excited about the Windows Store. And remember, there is that contest as well to get your app into the store at beta. So I think a lot of people are excited, and there's even an internal one going on as well.
Yeah, I mean, it really is the key point here in terms of expanding that reach. It's a new market. If you're in the business of software development or on yourself, it's all about opportunities, right? And so this is a great time to be investing and jumping in right now.
Yeah, I'm personally pretty excited about it, too. So, moving to our next story, you know, CES was going on, and one of the announcements for developers that you'll be interested in is the Connect for Windows. So what's this?
Yeah, so Connect for Windows, as Steve Ballmer announced on Monday, that it would be shipping on February 1st, 2012, the Connect for Windows along with the SDK. The hardware is around $250. It gives us the commercial rights. A lot of the things... that we've been playing with, as you know, we've done a lot in Coding for Fun and with the Connect beta, and even being at the kickoff back in June,
we've been playing
on all that stuff. So it's a lot of fun, but there were a lot of those unanswered questions, right? What about commercial use, all these types of things. So this is going to be something that's really interesting. If you go through the blog, you'll also notice that they talk about the near. They're focusing on near gesture, and that was one of the biggest points that we wanted working on the beta. So I'm really excited. Can't wait to get my hands on this and just really see how it explodes out. I'm really looking forward to this.
Yeah, and I think the key takeaway is there's going to be a different piece of hardware, and that's the piece of hardware that's going to support near.
Yeah, absolutely. You can still, I believe they're extending the beta license out for a couple more years, but those are not commercial. It's just for people who do want to do this, definitely jump over to this new hardware. With the updated SDKs, a lot of goodies in there that should really make this thing pop.
And for sure, we'll have more stuff on. We'll be updating our Connect for Windows SDK quick start and a lot of our samples, and definitely a lot of good stuff to come for Connect demos going forward. So, which brings us to the Windows Phone Starter Kit, Social, RSS, and Schools and WordPress. So the idea here is you are a Windows Phone developer and you want to look through, say, for example, starter kits, and people are probably familiar with some starter kits here, but you can see some of the screenshots. They walk through the basics of, for example, pulling in an RSS feed and doing the typical navigation. And you actually see this in, for example, the Windows 8 SDK samples as well. There's an RSS feed reader. It shows you a series of feeds, then goes into sort of like a detail view. You get all the back stack and all the wonderful navigation within there as well. So if you're looking to basically start off from something, and a lot of times, you know, certain Windows Phone apps are really nothing more than an RSS feed reader for, you know, Britney Spears or something. So this is kind of a great starting point. And for your application.
It's a great time for it, too, right? With CES, with the Nokia phones that have been announced, we talked about the global market. If you haven't gone into Windows Phone development right now, this is a good, it's a safe, on-ramps you quickly on a very common function to do. So it's really good to get your feet wet right now. If you haven't started earlier, now's a great time to do it.
Okay, cool. Definitely cool stuff. And which brings us, while we were talking about Windows 8, this is Windows 8 and the Future of XAML Part 1. So what is this exactly?
Yeah, well, Gil wrote this series. This is part one, so he's easing everybody into it. But it really is on the future of XAML. It's nice to see a report. There's so much controversy back and forth and developers and a lot of heated opinions. But this was a good series. I enjoyed it. He's starting it in terms of basically what is the future of XAML with Windows 8, how it's shifting, how it's evolving. I'm a fan of these types of series. He doesn't get too much into code in this first part, but I'm really looking forward to seeing where it comes out. But he paints a really good, unbiased, in my opinion, picture of basically what's changing, how we can start leveraging the XAML that we may have learned if we're coming from Silverlight or WPF and interacting with it on the WinRT, kind of what all the parts are and kind of where they go together. So if you weren't at Build or you just haven't had time the past couple of months to kind of on-ramp with day job work, this is a good... very fair.
Get up to speed article.
Get up to speed article. So, exactly. Looking forward to more of it.
Okay, cool stuff. Now, the next one is actually a friend of the show, Chris Sells, who did a wonderful demo that we have talked about on the show on showing how to build a Coding for Fun RSS reader in Windows 8 at one of the Build Day 1 talks. Mm-hmm. So what is this article exactly?
Yeah, so here they're bringing in... In their own words, they basically said there's a lot of good practices here in JavaScript. Mm-hmm. And so as we're bringing in JavaScript programmers to develop on the actual platform itself, it's kind of this meeting both ways, because there's definitely a very established way of coding at Microsoft, if you were coding .NET, if you were coding C# in the past. And the JavaScript community have also developed their own kind of ways of doing things. It's not a question of which one's better or not. It's which one you're familiar with. So these window libraries are basically that kind of transitional library so that you can help get that mindset proper of now working in the stack. In this first part one, they're basically building kind of like just getting something done on part one. So it's really good to ease you into it. But later on in subsequent parts, they'll be talking about working directly with the DOM and stuff like that. So, again, another great series. We're seeing a lot of these sprout up. This Windows for Libraries, you know, the other ones we've mentioned, where it's easing people into this development environment. Again, I can't get enough of these things. It's a perfect time for it.
Cool. So, one of mine, and, you know, this is Dan Rigby, and he's talking about something that I'm sure all of us have done, and what you see here, and hopefully you can make it out, it is sort of small code, two implementations of iNotify property change. The one on the left is the classic MSDN that we're probably all familiar with. The one on the right is one that he had seen Anders do. And while there's certain things I do like about it, the fact that we can use generic, so we don't have to set a specific type on this, I actually worry that it's a little less readable, and the fact that everybody has one way to do iNotify property change, and maybe there's a couple different things where you're seeing people, for example, you know, maybe have MVVM templates where iNotify property change is built once in a generic way and then reused. What I worry about is, you know, I'm looking at this code, there's some other stuff I have to worry about, what a quality comparer and then... what the default and then what the method equals is going to actually do within there and then the return value. And he looks at it from a line of code, and I actually don't see a lot of difference in terms of lines of code, certainly for reusability in terms of types. But when you start, like, where people should focus their effort, I think, should be on problems that haven't been solved versus, hey, 80% of the world is already doing it this way or these couple ways. Doing something else that maybe shaves off a couple lines of code but is more difficult to read.
You know, I feel the same way a lot. And I'm coming in from a lot of these more advanced features. We're learning through code. So as someone who always thinks of himself as a new student of these languages, when I look at this, the way that they're showing here it's very data dense. Just it looks a lot more dense. And the first one, as someone learning the languages, definitely a lot easier to understand. But I get the appeal of what they're saying, that because it is very clever what he's doing, right?
Yeah, and
it's
sometimes
clever, and so I didn't think about that.
I think language features, sometimes you do clever, and I get on Clint on this sometimes, like, this code, there's no reason you can't put just an if statement instead of trying to do this, like, nested of a function to be able to do a tertiary. I'm old-fashioned. I like my code readable.
Yeah.
Call me crazy. All right, so that's my thoughts. Share your thoughts. What do you think? This is a cool thing. Cloud Numerics Lab and reusable stuff for algorithms in the cloud. So what's the details here?
Yeah, this is really interesting, and on a very specific type of problem, right? What's great about here is they're releasing this. It's not something I personally am going to be working on right now. We're working on some kind of fun coding for fun stuff that isn't leveraging advanced algorithms across the cloud yet.
Yeah.
But here, this package, it really allows the leveraging of C#, mm-hmm. right? So you can plug into their libraries for doing these types of very heavy algorithm computational intense operations, and then plugging it right into Azure as well.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're into that type of thing, if this is kind of your niche on where you're focusing, or it's the type of application you want, what I like about this from kind of the UI side looking in is that it is representative of the type of problems that we're facing in enterprise applications and a lot of these applications. Data is so important. The cloud
mm-hmm.
is so important. And up until now, it has been very much in that niche. It's kind of your full-time job doing that. And if you worked in the managed languages like C# or whatever, there's this big jump of what we would normally do and then trying to get into tackling these types of problems. So for that, these types of bridges are really interesting, because we're going to be seeing more and more very big data sets. The needs to crunch through those data sets and being able to leverage Azure is just fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times people wouldn't consider certain problems. It's like, there's no way we could crunch all of our data in real time and build a report the next day. You know, reports are always going to take 2 days, you know, as one example, or linear algebra. I actually think, you know, it'd be kind of fun to do some fun stuff with linear algebra. So, like, you know, figuring out the fastest, you know, times to go through a McDonald's line or some stupid optimization like that. I'm sure we can think of something kind of more fun and clever than fast food. But lots of cool stuff to play with there. Entity Framework, part one. So we've talked about Entity Framework quite a bit and put into some of the great Scott Guthrie tutorials. This is kind of it in video form. So the idea is Entity Framework, a lot of people are familiar with object relational mapping. This really takes an Entity Framework based on how do you want to code. So for example, mm-hmm. do you want to code, do code first and actually have a model built on your code, meaning you're not a database person, I'm building code, I don't even know if I'm going to have a database. I write my code, and then the backing store is built based on my code. I'm changing stuff in C#, and it's actually changing my database. I don't have to be a database developer to do that. And then the a lot of us grew up with in the stored procedure world where, and maybe we have a set database, and this is what can and can't go into the database, which is the other way, where you start with the model and the database first, and then generate the classes and objects, and really walks through the different ways that you can use Entity Framework. And Entity Framework, you know, the goal is not to have one approach to the other. It's to support all.
Yeah.
So if you're not familiar with Entity Framework, there's a lot of good comments in here. And send Robert comments as well. Do you want more demos, less demos, more talking, and so on? So cool stuff, and kudos, Robert.
Again, we're seeing another part one. That's kind of the theme of this week. I think new year, everybody's jumping in, everybody's starting these series.
We finally got to tell people
exactly.
about Entity Framework. They say they don't know. This next one is garbage collectors in the age of smart pointers. So the idea is, what's going on with the smart pointer facilities in C++ 11? And there's probably three features in another interesting article that was pointed out here. So one is the idea of having a unique pointer. And that pointer is my pointer. It can't be shared. When the instance is destroyed, underlying pointer is deleted. Shared, then we're doing things like, for example, having a ref counter when, and then we're worrying about, when the last shared pointer instance is actually destroyed, then we do it. And then weak pointer, which is, you're not really sure if the underlying pointer can actually be deleted. And then there's a bunch of things, and even examples for people who aren't necessarily familiar with this in .NET for, say, weak references. Yeah. It's very similar to weak reference implementation on .NET for GC. And one of the most interesting articles was a third-party vendor that has been talking about garbage collection and the benefits of garbage collection. So a lot of people say, you know, if I'm managing my own memory, I can be a lot faster because I can decide when to delete it, but then you're deleting all at once and people are doing it in the amount of time versus, say, having GC do it. And what they've done is this particular vendor, and this is for a Java JVM, but they actually have a large concurrent object that's running in parallel that looks at the JVM and is basically doing real-time predictable garbage collection, which I think is probably the most interesting thing. So if you have really large garbage collection heaps, like 4 gigs, and you know we're doing a bunch of just data collection stuff, maybe some Hadoop or whatever, the ability to have known garbage collection time, so it's not like, hey, my app isn't responsive, oh, it's just the garbage collector, that thing goes through. So for people who are really interested in garbage collection, I think this is...
Or pointers.
Yeah, or pointers, or C++ 11 specifically.
There you go.
Which brings us to going native.
Going native 2012. So I'm really excited about the whole going native show. I think that started around Build, right? Mm-hmm. I wasn't with Microsoft at the time, right? But before Build, native wasn't even on my map. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really excited about this. This is going to be February 2nd and 3rd.
Right.
And so since Build, I've...
Here. In fact, we're going to be streaming it live on Channel 9 as well.
Oh, really? Great.
Yeah.
Even better. So the keynote is going to be Bjorn, right?
Yeah.
And that'll be Thursday morning. I'm really looking forward to that. Kind of C++ 11 style. 2 days jam-packed of stuff. I'm going to be there if I can get my boss to let me go. and then Friday, it wraps up with this great interactive panel with Herb Sutter, who has popped dead center on my radar. And since then, I've become a really big fan of him. So I'm looking forward to this. I think we've seen these changes of JavaScript, of what we traditionally consider development in Microsoft, and expanding out to include both ends kind of that spectrum of the very open web and JavaScript bringing it in, as well as getting back to this native code with C++ 11, DirectX 11.1. So this is a very timely topic. I'm not all in. I still love managed code. Of course, we still do most of our work here, but I'm going to be there. I know a lot of people are starting to get excited, people who haven't traditionally been native. This is a really good time for it.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people are C++ developers and, you know, sort of feeling underappreciated in a conference like this, and I still think they have a few spots, so make sure to register, because I think the ability to rub elbows with guys like Herb Sutter, Bjorn, and, there's a template god who's just amazing in templates, and Charles has the whole schedule on for day one. It's probably the coolest part, that you get to hang out with these people and have that exposure and just that knowledge, because a lot of times, you know, like, bring your problem up to them, and they'll be like, actually, that's here's our real-world example of how we run into this, and I think that's really the most valuable part of being in these sessions.
Because that's what they want when they're having dinner after the conference. Come up, hey, I was wondering if you could help me with
Believe
this.
Believe it or not, yeah. You know, a lot of those times, these conferences are designed for that kind of mingling. So kudos to this.
And C++ developers, hats off to you.
Yeah.
That's my C++ corny joke of the day.
Oh, God.
That's bad.
So SQL Server 2012 Virtual Labs. So the idea here is, if you haven't played with SQL Server 2012, you want to be able to get up to speed. They have things like business intelligence, operations, database management, and so on. These are virtual labs, meaning you connect up, mm-hmm. you know, it does the downloading, the little client part, and then you install, and then you can actually run it on an instance. So you don't have to download the tools, the management studio, the whatever, to basically get something up and running very quickly. And it's built and designed for that lab. So for developers specifically, there's a lot of things about managing your database. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things around BI. And for developers specifically, there's what's new in T-SQL that I think folks may be familiar with. For example, like the ability to do the fetch next, the ability to do try catch, if, try convert. A lot of things that actually are very familiar in, say, C#, where you try and convert, try parse, for example, mm-hmm. as one example, when I trying to convert one data type to another, is now native in T-SQL. So definitely check out the T-SQL enhancements if you're a developer and a lot of the e-business stuff. So plenty to play there. And this article is about lessons learned from unit testing T-SQL. And, you know, a while back on my blog, I actually posted about, because I was doing just a ton of database work and importing, I mean, millions and millions of rows. And one of the things I felt like I didn't have was a great way to do unit testing. And even today, the tools that exist for unit testing just aren't really that great. Mm-hmm. So this Alex Kuznetsov walks through their own experience of building unit testing into their database and some of the practices and things that I found actually kind of interesting where they were like, if you have really basic stored procedures, don't bother writing a unit test because the stored procedure is basically the unit test. Like, you can't write less code. You can't make an atomic test of that. It's probably not worth the time for really simple stuff. Spend your time on, you know, the 50-100 line of code T-SQL that's doing a ton of stuff, and that's where your errors come in. That's where a change to something can subtly change behavior, and so on. So a lot of interesting practices, and really I still think a big opportunity in terms of making it easier for developers to do things like unit testing. And they actually do all their unit testing from C#, because there is still no, instead of doing it from T-SQL, or calling T-SQL unit tests from C#, because there's, for example, doing things where multiple results are back, where I'm getting both, you know, the person's ID and his whole data set. There is not the most intuitive in T-SQL, and so on. But really, these are sort of lessons learned from somebody that's done it, and a lot of interesting stuff there.
I've done it quite a bit.
Yeah. So, which brings us to the ALM Summit, and I love this title, Project Patterns from Adrenaline Junkies to Template Zombies. So what is this exactly?
So this event, flashback, right, happened a couple months back, but this was a really interesting talk. His main argument basically is that their patterns, your company patterns might actually be, and your company practices may actually be more beneficial than best practices, in theory, design patterns, right? So if you read the talk, he spends quite a bit talking about patterns early on, but toward the middle and then deep into the end, he's talking about, for example, more real-world project patterns that come up. Mm-hmm. So we all know best practices. He makes the argument that it's kind of like best practices in health, right? There's probably nobody who does every single healthy best practice, right? They kind of pick and choose, and you morph it into something that you also try and keep up regularly. Okay. So in his company, he talks about these are the patterns that they've found that are basically their company patterns. And I know in my experience in the past couple of years working in enterprise-level software, firsthand, I really found the truth of this as well. The company had developed a lot of patterns that were kind of unique to the company, right? It's a common phenomenon. And you go in there, and that aspect of supporting those and teaching those, all in all, creates a better deliverable at the end of the day and a stronger company if it's done right. But you can have those anti-patterns in there as well. So it's a really interesting talk if you're into that aspect at all, the kind of compare and contrast of best practices versus your company practices.
Okay, cool stuff. Which brings us to our picks of the week. So, Rick, this is your pick.
Yeah, the link came up just a little bit ago. If you guys haven't played the Cut the Rope on IE, that was done. It was a big splash in CES. Mm-hmm. There are even pictures floating around where they've created the browser around a classic arcade style game, so you can play there. So it's been getting a lot of coverage at CES. It's a great, great port of a very, very popular game, Cut the Rope. It's highly addictive, and I'm sure it'll be just as addictive on IE. But besides the application being launched, I think this is my pick of the week, because if you go in there, you watch the video, but then you start reading about it, there's a lot of interesting things that have happened as they've needed to convert Objective-C, right, over to HTML5 and leveraging Canvas. And to me, it was a developer behind the scenes that went in a little bit deeper than I kind of was expecting. I was expecting it to be a little bit lighter, and not deep in terms of here's all the code, but deep in terms of here's really the patterns, and here are the problems that we wrestled with, here are the challenges, here are things that came easier, but things like working with struct back and forth from Objective-C to, you know, JavaScript and choices that were made. And there's also some additional articles on here in terms of when they ran into working with audio on the web. But definitely shout out to, besides the the main company who wrote the game. They got our buddies Pixel Lab, Adam Kinney and Robbie Ingebrigtsen.
Friends of the show.
So shout outs to Robbie and Adam there. They pop up in the video as well. And they continue talking a little bit more if you're focused on the UI side of the conversion process. I really, really liked it. It's nice seeing people we like on video doing their thing, people top of the game, and really giving an honest evaluation of what's going on. So that's my pick of the week.
Cool stuff. So my pick of the week is actually, I thought this was kind of a fun one here. A hexadecimal number pad eases your IPv6 conversion. So the idea is you want to basically be able to convert between to the IPv6 numbers, right? So I put in an IPv4 and then map it to the IPv6 numbers. If you're a total geek in terms of this stuff and you really don't want, for example, to have that hexadecimal value.
Absolutely.
You know, and I'm sure people have done the ipconfig and seen the IPv6 thing and you're like, wow, that's crazy. It's $20. I think it's actually just kind of a fun gag gift, but I love it. I think there should be like a binary keyboard too, and it's just ones and just zeros.
That'd be great. I need this one just because half the day I'm in graphics programs, right? Well, I'm not in coding, so maybe we can expense that out.
Yeah, so you know, if you need a hexadecimal number pad, you can do the easy conversion, and maybe a lot of people are playing with hexadecimal. I don't know.
So designers, we are.
Yeah, exactly. So that's our show, and thank you, Rick.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll see you all next week. Thanks.
See ya.